Things come back to haunt you. I can just tell you a story about this particular passage. Before my conversion, Debbie had been converted, and I think they were working on me prayerfully, but she would get some ladies to come round to the house and do Bible studies and in the service. And I got talking to a couple of them one day about this, and I said, you do realize, of course, that Elijah was taken up to heaven in a spaceship. And, of course, the argument was very, very simple, because, you see, Isabel's looking at me like I need help. You could actually make a very coherent argument, you see, because the argument was at the day, the only vehicle they understood was a chariot. So if Elijah seen a vehicle coming from the sky, it would be described as a chariot. And of course, because it was propulsion, it had flames coming out of it. That was the flames and the power of it. And the whirlwind, of course, was the suction of the thing in that sense. And Elijah was taken up into a spaceship, transposed into a spaceship. I mean, all this. I added to that that, of course, he didn't put water on the offering on Mount Carmel. It was some form of paraffin or petrol, and it self-combusted and all the rest of it. I find it very interesting that you do those sort of things, and God brings it back to you. And now I find myself here tonight teaching it as a believer, very much in the miraculous and truth of what actually happened. Now, I've been highlighting, as we've gone through Elijah so far, that this has really been something of an exercise of obedience for Elijah. We've witnessed his obedience in a whole variety of ways. We've witnessed his obedience despite the times that he was living in, despite the circumstances in which he found himself, despite the danger that seemed to constantly face him, and the overwhelming opposition that was before him. We've seen his obedience when God appeared to delay. And then we've seen that incredible victory on Mount Carmel, followed by that remarkable example of his obedience despite his own weakness, because, of course, he'd been on such a spiritual high, only to come down off the mountain and be told that Jezebel was looking to kill him. And we've seen his obedience despite his own personal weakness. He actually reached that point where he wanted to just lie down and die. And some of us have been there. But God, in his grace, restored him. And we witnessed Elijah's obedience in God's recommissioning. And then in the last couple of messages, we've sort of zoomed out from Elijah. And we've been reminded that God is still very much at work in the bigger picture. It's not just through Elijah. And we've looked at the wars with Syria. We've looked at the judgment of God that followed the incident of Naboth's vineyard. And we looked at the consequential death of Ahab. And then last week, Elijah re-entered the scene. And George took us through the short but tragic reign of King Ahaziah. And so tonight, we consider Elijah's obedience in his departure. As a soldier, we would often say that the measure of a real man was in the way he died. And the truth was, we were in an occupation where death was there, ever present. And the reality was that how you faced death was really what you were all about. Because death takes away all the niceties. It takes away all the comfort factors that we tend to surround ourselves with. So a man who dies well, a man who gives himself for others or dies with confidence in his God, that's the measure of the man. It was once said that one of the strongest supports to the New Testament was, with these disciples, so many of whom were martyred, have died for a lie. And of course they wouldn't. No man's going to die for a lie in that sense. Now, to be fair, Elijah doesn't die. But we find Elijah being obedient to God to the very end. And quite a remarkable and dramatic end it is. Now, whilst the departure of Elijah is the focus of this story, we should not lose sight of what is going on in the background, because we have a handover takeover of prophets. We have one preparing to depart, his ministry complete, his ministry finished. We have the other stepping up, his ministry just beginning. We see the hand of God in the whole process from beginning to end. We also have the engagement of the wider prophetic family of believers. There's something very special, very intimate going on here regarding God and his called people, as it were, in terms of his prophets. Now, it's a very short and focused passage, so I'm not going to break it down into points. The easiest thing for us to do is just take the passage as it is before us and work our way through it. And when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. We'll come back to the nature of that departure at the point of departure a little bit later on. But I want us to pause here and consider one of the core threads that we've been witnessing with regard to Elijah, but also particularly here in relation to Elisha. And that is with regard to calling. Because you see, whilst I hope our circumstances are nothing like as dramatic, we actually find ourselves in exactly the same place in eternity as a church. I am about to leave. To the best of my knowledge, it will not be in a chariot of fire, but in a box, like everybody else. Oh, in a box? What am I talking about? I've lost the plot. Okay. And I sincerely hope I'm not being prophetic. If I am, that'll give you a laugh. So I'm about to leave and move on. And I'm about to be replaced. But the thing that we've got to remember here when you're doing these sort of things is our need is not for another pastor to simply be appointed or called by God, but it is to be anointed to carry out the task which God has got for him to do. We're not looking to fill a job. We're looking for a man of God, called by God, to do that which God has purposed for him. You see, firstly, we need to remember here that the Lord had made Elijah very clear on Mount Horeb who was to replace him. It was to be Elisha. He was going to finish what he began. And that's not always easy for people, because you remember David wanted to build a temple and the Lord said, no, Solomon's going to do that. But the Lord had made it very clear that Elijah wouldn't finish this particular battle. But he had also made it very clear to Elisha. And as I think of this in terms of application, we've been thinking about calling recently, not unsurprisingly. And I find myself a little bit confused with the debate that's going on today. How does God open and close doors, etc.? And the problem, as I understand it, is this, that the subjective and the objective aspects of our calling can get confused. And when that starts to happen, you're on dangerous ground. Because what happens is the objective, what God wants, can easily flip and become the subjective, what I want or what I would like. It's interesting. It was pretty hard, and I checked. I tried to think of every passage that I could in the Bible. But other than the case of young Samuel, I couldn't find any example of doubt or confusion about a calling of God. Now, even Jonah, who objected to what God had called him to do, Jonah knew the calling. He ran away from it, but he knew the calling. So to me, the call of God is clear. And then secondly, we need to ask, if that's the point, Is the call of God equally clear today? And I can see no reason why it shouldn't be. Because you see, the call of God will often involve material sacrifice. The call of God will often involve stepping out in faith. The call of God will often avoid taking you out of your comfort zone. Consider Elisha, in a comfortable, well-off family, we believe. And then along comes Elijah and says, follow me. And he gives it all up. At the drop of a hat. That was serious. He knew God had put his hand on him. When we consider the disciples that Jesus called, we have this lovely picture of the fishermen fixing their nets and Jesus saying, follow me, and they drop the nets and off they go. They're dropping their livelihood. They're dropping the means of supporting their family. This is not something they're going to do on a whim or a casual say-so. This is a call of God. That's what I mean. And it will involve you stepping out of your comfort zone. Think of David, young shepherd boy, suddenly finding himself confronted by Goliath. Call of God is certain. And certainly, in my own experience, the call of God has been very clear at every point. It's often involved material sacrifice. It has never involved want. You understand the difference? It's involved pain. It's involved no small amount of difficulty, which is why over the years I've valued that calling. Because without that calling, I would never have endured. But with that calling, I simply wouldn't want to be anywhere else. And God took me right out of my comfort zone. Well promoted, well organized soldier at a key point in my military career. I had it all before me. And the Lord said, give it all up. I wasn't going to do that on a whim. But I did, with a wife and two young children. And then they wanted me to become a padre, and that sounded a great idea, the easy option. You know, just put pips on my shoulder and crosses on my shirts, and away I go. And get the salary and the pension and everything else. I said, isn't God good? That wasn't what God called us for. God wanted to send us to the mission field as missionaries. And then we tried to find a church. Then we tried to find a Bible college. And we ended up going back to South Africa. And I was going to go for 3 years. And then the Lord said, no, you don't need to go for 3 years. You and Debbie need to go for a year. And you've got to understand how all of these things were going on in our life that were so unnatural. They weren't a good fit. And yet we knew it was the will of God. And they took me right out of my comfort zone. I was an ex-SAR major, used to having authority and rank and a big stick. And they took that off me and they gave me a Bible and they said, go tell these soldiers about Jesus. I was petrified. I'm telling you the truth. I feared no man in my life and very few women. And there all of a sudden, I had to go and tell these soldiers about Jesus. That's calling. Do you know what? God in his grace kept us, guided us, and blessed us. That, my guys, is calling. And I just wonder today, are we losing something of that directness of God's call? Because I believe a man without God's call will not survive. In fact, I would say you've got no chance of surviving. Now, we've no way of knowing how Elisha accompanied Elijah as his servant and protege. But now the time had come for the transition to occur, in verse 2. And Elijah said to Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel. But Elisha said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So they went down to Bethel. These events are organized around a journey that begins at Gilgal. And then they proceed to Bethel and then down to Jericho. It's a journey that's very similar, in fact, to Samuel used to do a circuit around this area once every year. Pardon me, there's a certain significance to it. But it's a journey that will ultimately bring them back to the Jordan, where it all effectively began for the nation of Israel under Joshua. And at each stop, Elijah seems to make an effort to deter Elisha. Please stay here, Elisha. And it seems a somewhat half-hearted effort. He never actually insists or instructs him. He says, you know, please. He asks him. And he seems to be testing the younger man's loyalty and determination. And he seems to be giving him a get-out clause, if you like. Think back to that, remember that time when he went and he anointed him by calling him? And he said to him in 1 Kings 19 and 20, go back again, for what have I done to you? The other thing that I can draw from that is that it is fair to say that we can test a call and we can affirm a call. And Elijah is certainly affording Elisha the opportunity to take a step back. But he has the call of God written in his heart as well. As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. And then we come to a rather profound and telling encounter. And the sons of the prophets who were in Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, do you know that today the Lord will take away your master from over you? And he said, yes, I know. Now keep quiet. Now references to these bands or groups of prophets goes all the way back to Samuel, 1 Samuel 10 and 19. But it's interesting, isn't it, that they didn't appear in our story until after Elijah bemoaned his isolation. Let me remind you of some words of Elisha back in chapter 19 of 1 Kings in verse 14. And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord, this is Elijah, the Lord of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I only, I'm left. Do you remember those words? Elisha felt he was on his own. And God responds in verse 18, yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel. And these bands of prophets were obviously there. They didn't spring up overnight. But Elijah had been so consumed by himself and his loneliness, he lost the big picture. And it's almost as if God revealed them to him as an encouragement. And there's certainly going to be further evidence than our story in 2 Kings. We'll see it in chapter 5, we'll see it in chapter 6, we'll see it again in chapter 9. But this also reveals that the knowledge of Elijah's departure was known beyond just the two prophets. I find this interesting that God hadn't just revealed it to Elijah and Elisha. And Elisha, he seems very concerned, in fact, as he says, yes, I know, now keep quiet. Like he doesn't want too many other people to know about this. In fact, he wants nobody else to know about this. He's probably a bit surprised that the prophets even know about this. And then Elijah makes his second offer to Elisha to stay, and it is declined in like manner in verse 4. Elijah said to him, Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho this time. But he said, as the Lord lives, as you yourself live, I will not leave you. There's a stubbornness about this man which is beautiful, because it's a faithful stubbornness. And their arrival at Jericho brings about a deja vu moment. So they came to Jericho. The sons of the prophet who were at Jericho drew near to Elisha and said to him, do you know, et cetera, et cetera? And he says, yes, I know, and I keep it quiet. This continued affirmation of God's people is wonderful because it's building support. This is bigger than Elisha and Elijah. And the outside affirmation of God's saints is something that we should all treasure and value. I have certainly found it a great encouragement over the years when others have been able to confirm God's plan and purpose for me. When there have been difficulties in the church and one thing or another, I have asked other men that I know and respect as men of God for their advice, so that I'm not sitting there in my own pity party, seeing things only as I understand them, but seeking the wider counsel of God. Well, here, these guys are being given the prophetic counsel of all the prophets in that sense. And we see that with the repeated affirmation. Then Elijah said to him, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan this time." And of course, we get the same response, and the two men move on. And from there, they journeyed to the west bank of the Jordan River. We were told 50 men. Now, it's interesting, are these another 50 prophets? Are they some of the prophets? It matters not. But there are now a further 50 prophets who went and stood some distance from them, and they were both standing at the Jordan. From the opening comment about the whirlwind, this has been a slow, repetitive build-up. But we've now arrived at the Jordan, and the miraculous finale is about to take place. And Elijah takes his cloak, and he rolls it up, and he struck the water. And the water was parted to one side and to the other, till the two of them could go over in dry ground. Where did your mind immediately go to? To Moses? Good, I'm not alone then. Images of Moses and Joshua immediately come to mind. The Jordan was the symbolic border of the nation. I'll come back to that in a wee moment. But it was a place of rich biblical significance. It was the boundary that Moses was not at that time allowed to cross. I always like to make the point that Moses did get to the promised land. When did he get to the promised land? Along with who? With who? Elijah. Okay, but Moses did stand in the promised land. It just took a bit of time, but he was out of time, so it didn't really make any difference, okay? But this, at this point, this was the boundary he wasn't allowed to cross. And so Joshua would lead the people. And the parallel with Moses and the Red Sea is striking, pun intended. Moses raised his staff, the symbol of his authority and shepherd leadership over the water, while Elijah struck it with his cloak, the symbol of his prophetic offices. Some commentators here we have to do a wee bit of geography, suggest that they're now outside the land in Moab. Now, the problem is there's a lot of fluidity about the borders on that side of the Jordan. But the best research that I can determine is that this part was still in Israel, the northern kingdom, at this particular time, and Moab had been compressed a little bit further south. But it was a varied area. The important thing for me is it would have been in this area that Moses was buried, that Moses was stopped from crossing. And so it's the symbolic border, if you like, whether it was the actual border or not. But just a little point of accuracy. A lot of people slip into saying, and I nearly did it in our discussions, you know, he's now out of the promised land, as it were. But that's not the case, technically. And the significance for me is that this is the point where Moses was buried. We should never force significance, but we should always consider the possibility. And I believe there's a strong possibility here. So let me just make my point for you. Both divided bodies of water, the Red Sea and the Jordan River, both had fire from heaven come down upon a sacrifice. And Moses 1, by the way, is Leviticus 9, 22, 24. They both met the Lord on Mount Sinai. They both experienced miraculous provision of food. They both ended their earthly lives in remarkable ways so that their bodies could not be located by those who remained. I would believe Moses died, but God buried him, and no one knew where. Both had significant successors who continued the work and the plan and the purpose of God, Joshua and Elisha. And then finally, the point I've already implied, they both stood with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. So I think there's a valid link with Elijah and Moses, even if we can't understand the fullness of it. Now, up to this point, the only thing we've really learned about Elisha in terms of his personality is that he is stubbornly faithful. And that's a pretty good attribute to have. I used to have a lot of soldiers that were like that, and they made good soldiers. If a man is faithful and stubborn, he's normally a good man to have covering your back. But we're about to learn something else about him now, the spiritual aspect of him. And when they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Ask what I shall do for you before I'm taken from you." And Elisha said, "Please let there be a double portion of your spirit for me." And this can cause a few problems in terms of translation and indeed commentary and understanding. We need to be careful. But let me share a few thoughts. Firstly, the term double portion is a Hebrew idiom. It does not mean twice as much, but rather it is the firstborn's share. So if you turn over to Deuteronomy 29, and the important thing here is to see the right of inheritance. We have a situation here, if you go down to verse 15, and now we're not going to get into a man having two wives and all the rest of it. The fact is where the rights of the firstborn lie. If a man has two wives, one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him children, and if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then on the day when he assigns his possessions as an inheritance to his sons, he may not treat the son of the loved as the firstborn in preference to the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the firstfruits of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. And I believe this is the sense in which Elijah is speaking. Oh, is it? Well, I do apologize. I've seen you flicking in your Bibles. My apologies. I'm one of those weeks. Okay, thank you for that, George. 21:15, was it, yeah? It's right, okay, I apologize. The second thing that I want to show you that I think supports this is the English expression causes us to think that Elisha was asking for twice as much as Elijah had. But it's obvious that we're talking here about a spirit. And ultimately, that reference to Elijah's spirit is God's spirit in Elijah. That's what Elisha wants. And God's spirit is not something that can be divided up and parceled out. Okay? That to me is fairly straightforward. But then thirdly, and we've seen this the whole way through this passage, there are many sons of the prophets. And 50 of them are now waiting on the other side of the Jordan. But Elisha has been told by Elijah that he is effectively the firstborn son of the prophets, as it were. Because why shouldn't it go to any of the rest of them? But spiritually, he has been called, he has been anointed, he is the rightful heir under the terms of the inheritance law, which I've got down as Deuteronomy 21. Sorry, that I just referred to. Apologies. In short, it was to inherit Elijah's role. And if he was to do that properly, he needed God's equipping to do it. To be given the job in itself simply wasn't enough. And then fourthly, and then you need to look forward for this one, look down to verse 12. Elisha refers to Elijah as he's taken up as my father, my father. So you have this constant link, the firstborn, in terms of the prophets. But God's Spirit is God's Spirit, and not even Elijah can allocate God's Spirit. And so he gives him a sign. And he said, you have asked a hard thing, yet if you see me, and I am being taken up from you, it shall be so for you. But if you do not see me, it shall not be so. And this request displays humility and spiritual maturity. You see, Elisha is concerned for him being equipped by God. He's about to step into Elijah's shoes. And believe me, I've seen men when they got promotion and they go seriously wrong. Goes to their head. They get promoted beyond the point of their own ability, etc. And it can be a disaster. But Elisha is looking for God's enabling. He's not worried about the rank he has, the prophetic cloak that he will wear. He wants God's enabling, which shows humility and spiritual maturity for me. He has a desire for and a dependency on God. Now, guys, if you want to nurture something in your life, take those two things, a desire for and a dependency on God. And you put those two things above everything else in your life and every other person in your life. And I say that with my wife sitting there. Okay? A desire for and a dependency on God. That's what we need as believers. Now, the departure of Elijah into heaven was filled with divine symbolism. And as they still went and talked, behold, chariots of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them. That must have been a heck of an experience. Okay. Now, chariots and horses were military symbols. And we see them used as representative of God himself, as the ultimate protection of his people. And I hope that's in Deuteronomy 20 and 1 and 2 Kings 6 and 15. But there's a further point in this symbolism. Because in a nation that had been riddled with Baal worship, the chariots were refuted the false claim that Baal was the god of the clouds, that he rode the clouds, as it were. And so there's an amazing symbolism in the way God chooses to take Elijah up into heaven. And this is before his prophets, who would have all been versed in the claims of the Baals in that sense. God is the rider of the heavens. And Elijah went up in a whirlwind. Note, he didn't go up in a chariot. I find 9 Christians out of 10 tell you he went up in a chariot of fire. He didn't. He went up in a whirlwind. Elijah endured much in his life, particularly in relation to Ahab and Jezebel. And I find it telling when we consider their ignominious death that was associated for both of them with dogs, and the supernatural aspect of Elijah's departure, we see the reality of a great spiritual truth. The believer's future is in the eternal and in God's hands. The unbeliever is at best hopeless in that sense. Here was a king and a queen with so much authority, yet the dogs would lick their blood. Here was a prophet who suffered so much abuse, and yet the Lord takes him directly into his presence for all eternity. People don't like to talk about this contrast of believer and unbeliever. Here you have one, and it's glaring. Here you have one of two people who had everything that this world could offer. And that wasn't enough for them, so they took old Naboth's vineyard and the dogs licked his blood in the chariot. And Debbie pointed out to me when she was doing the reading of that, that, you know, all this dressing up and partitioning in the battlefield and all the rest, so it wasn't obvious what happened. A stray arrow just happened to find him. And his judgment is complete. Elisha's response is his spontaneous cry of grief. And this is lovely, actually. I find this a very sweet moment. He honors Elijah. And Elisha saw it and cried, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And he saw him no more. The telling statement, he saw him no more. Which meant he saw him. Which meant he was going to get the measure of Elijah's blessing and anointing. It's interesting, those very same words, if you go over to 2 Kings 13 and 14, I'm nervous now giving you references in case I've lost it completely here, but these very same words would be used of Elisha by King Joash. And now when Elisha had fallen sick with the illness with which he would die, Joash, king of Israel, went down to him and wept before him, crying, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. The very same words that he had used will be used by the king in relation to him. But back to our passage, he mourns his spiritual father. And then he took hold of his clothes and he tore them in two pieces. You know, it's okay to mourn. In fact, it's necessary to mourn. I get some Christians who say we should never mourn believers. Of course we can mourn believers. We're going to miss their company. If we're married, they're no longer going to be our partner in the way that we understand it now. That's not going to happen in heaven. Of course we're going to miss them in that sense. And so little passages like this just encourage me. It's okay to mourn. It's okay to miss someone. It shouldn't consume us, and of course we live with hope because we're going to be with them. But Jesus wept at the tomb of Lazarus and he knew he was going to bring him back from the dead. Do you understand me? It's good to mourn. Good for us. And then what Elijah did, or sorry, Elijah and Elisha, they're two terrible names, believe me, to work with in terms of tongue twisters. He literally takes up the mantle that has fallen to him. And he took up the cloak of Elijah that had fallen from him and went back and stood on the banks of the Jordan. Remember when Elijah had called him, the dramatic method of calling had been to put his cloak on him? Now he's putting that cloak on him for his own ministry and his own purpose. God had enabled him to witness a departure. The evidence was the cloak that had fallen from Elijah. This symbol of his prophetic office and his future divine empowerment. And that had been his concern. And now he is assured of that. And then he took the cloak of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water, saying, where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? Now he knew the deal. And now he asks a question. Elisha's cry was both a plea and a petition for God to authenticate him. And when he had struck the water parted to the one side and to the other. And Elisha went over. He had his answer. That must have been, in terms of Elisha's being, that must have been an absolutely wonderful moment. When the Lord gave him that personal affirmation. You see, Elijah may have departed, but everything of God remained. Israel didn't need Elijah. Israel needed God. Elisha's focus was on the God of the man, not on the man. And that's where our focus needs to be. I listen to so many people today who lift up their pastors and great preachers. Now, these are good guys and we're blessed by them and I've got no issues with that whatsoever. But some people build them up where they ought not to be. And it's, well, what are we going to do without them? We do not need men. We need God. And if God has taken a man from us, God has another man to replace him, as the case may be. You see, it's not man that we need. Because Elisha had been given not only his position, he had been given the authority. That was God's authority now resting on him. So what are we to make of this short but dramatic account? Well, to me, it's the unerring faithfulness of God through the whole story of Elijah and the purpose of God and the way God works as his plan unfolds. His power and authority are exercised repeatedly in the life of Elijah. Just think of it, the short account that we've studied. Elijah worshipped the Lord of the whole earth. You and I worship the Lord of the whole earth. But we also see the faithfulness and obedience of numerous servants of God, particularly those who were called as prophets. From the prophetic bands to Elisha the apprentice to Elijah the retiree. And when these two things come together, God in his faithfulness and man in his obedience and faithfulness, God is glorified. It can't be other. As I prepared these messages, I've used a lot of the points I've made tonight as a wee template just to hold up against my life. That's what Elijah did in that situation. What would I do? What would I hope to do? What have I done in similar situations? And just as we end off with our study on Elijah, I would encourage you to go back over these few chapters and just hold them up as a wee template. What would I do if everybody hated me? What would I do if God asked me to stand against 850 men? What would I do if God didn't answer my prayers when I wanted him to? What would I do when I fall apart and I want to run away? What would I do when God puts me back together and says, get back in there? What would I do? There's a good question to write in your Bible beside the name Elijah. Let's pray. Oh, Father God, I thank you for this man. I thank you for his testimony, for his witness. But Lord, help us to see behind the very familiar stories and see a man just like us, Lord, who has been called and equipped and enabled by you, the living God. A man who in every situation and circumstance was able to testify to your faithfulness, your great faithfulness, Lord, from the very basic needs of water to drink and food to eat to separating a river in order that he might be taken up to heaven, Lord. The Lord of heaven and earth, would you minister to us? Would you fill us with your spirit? Grant us wisdom and discernment, Lord, that we might correctly apply this word to our lives in order that we might glorify you.